Welcome into the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. I'm Eric Pfeiffer. The podcast today brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, also by Indiana Farm Bureau and Bex Hybrids. We thank them all for their support. And we are chatting Indiana Ag Policy, and you guessed it again today, we're talking about property taxes. This is the hot issue in Indiana Ag Policy, and they tell me I've got the guru of property taxes here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast today from Indiana Farm Bureau policy property tax guru, Katrina Hall. And Katrina, you've been going around, you've been doing all these presentations about property taxes. That's why they tell me that you are the guru here. Thanks for joining us on today's podcast.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, and I'm glad to do it. I have been around the state just a bit, and I imagine that over the course of the fall and until the legislative session starts, I'll be doing a whole lot more of that. So I'm excited, especially in the ag community, that farmers and their neighbors want to learn about what's going on in property taxes. I think everybody gets the message that the legislature has had this on their mind. And now, of course, the gubernatorial candidates have plans out there. So, yeah, it's a hot time in the tax world.
And really, you know, we've touched on it. We've talked about it. We had the lieutenant governor debate earlier here in August, and it's been touched on. It's been talked about. But what we wanted to do today was really get into the nuts and bolts of it. And that's where you come in. You've been talking about the nuts and bolts of this for quite some time, and not really just this time around. You've been talking about it for years now in your role with Indiana Farm Bureau. So if we can go back a little bit, if we can take a legal flashback here, Katrina, let's go back to the last time that we were talking about property taxes. And we touched on this on the last podcast we did with Kendall Culp, your vice president there, the Indiana Farm Bureau, and with Andy Tower. And we talked about the last time that property taxes were addressed. And we kind of knew that maybe we were kicking this can down the road a little bit from the standpoint of the fix for property taxes wasn't necessarily a permanent one. Can we go back to that point just to kind of get a historical perspective of where we're at and what kind of led to this point from the property tax perspective?
Well, the one thing I would say is property taxes in Indiana, at least in the last, 15 to 20 years, they've always been in a state of reform and relief. So overall, as far as farmland taxes are concerned, back in 20, when taxes were paid in 2003, that was when the emphasis on a market value and use value, and it's a capitalized net income approach, that's when that was really brought to the forefront. It had been used, but not according to the, that was just the Department of Local Government Finances mechanism. And so we, all of that has been codified at that point. And then over the years, as farm income has changed, and in some cases, as we all know, our income is based on global crop, global markets, and crop prices follow along with that. And so there is volatility in the formula to come up with the base value for taxation. And sometimes that, even though we had a major overhaul in 2016 that started for taxes payable in 2017, where we were trying to shave off the peaks and valleys, try to make the changes, the volatility show up in a less dramatic way. That has worked pretty well until a couple of things. First of all, farm income over the last couple of years spiked because of the forces from the pandemic, supply chain, the war in Ukraine, and so forth. So obviously that has brought more income to farmers' bottom line. but that also has rapidly declined in the last year. So where we are, just like we were back in 2015 and 16, when we were talking about changing the formula uses data, like real world data, to come up with the farm income. And there is a delay in that useful data is available. And so that's part of the problem, just like we had when we changed the formula. So those few years ago is we tried to narrow the gap on the delay in value, but and this year we may try to do some of that, but so essentially farm income will this fall, even though with a bumper crop, you know, you're going to be have less revenue per bushel. And we're also, but the formula is continuing to go up because it's using data from a couple of years ago. So, so that's the mismatch. And the other element is just that because of those rapid increases, because of the pandemic and market disruptions, those are those high years are what is in the 6-year rolling average. And so, we just have a mismatch. The other thing, the formula, as I said, is capitalized net income. And the thing that has happened is that when we got substantial reform back in 2016, the new element was that it used interest rates from farm loans, both operating and land, from the Chicago Fed. Well, what the General Assembly did then to mitigate and sort of chop up those peaks and valleys was to put a maximum capitalization rate in, and or default, essentially. So if your value is going up more than 10%, you defaulted to 8%. Well, in current circumstances, as all of our farmer and even just people generally know, interest rates in the last 18 months or so especially have escalated to the point where the real average of interest rates that are used in the formula is almost at 8%. So when you're at 8% as a cap rate, then you know, you're meeting there and there's really no mitigation from those peaks and valleys. So we have talked to fiscal leaders in the House and the Senate. We are reaching out to the campaigns for governor, and essentially for farmland, we want an adjustment in that cap rate, because where they set it in statute just isn't working necessarily for the market conditions that we have now, a lot of which are not isolated to Indiana, like every other property's value would be, including commercial and industrial or apartments, that especially on apartments that can use the capitalized net income approach, because that's all local conditions. So we're asking for some changes to the formula to try to mitigate these increases and get our members some relief. Now, that's one aspect of our property tax system that is really complicated. So we'll also be working with the General Assembly on some other concepts of reform that would try to manage bills for our members, which would just be general kinds of tax control concepts. And so we've been in discussions about those as well. I can elaborate on more on that global ideas if you want me to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a lot there, Katrina. There are a number
of things.
No, you're fine. Those are the nuts and bolts we wanted to get into. I mean, these are the one thing that jumped out at me, and it's true. The property tax, I mean, it's complicated. It is super complicated, and for people that aren't studying this every day, which I'm guessing many of our farmers are not. I mean, they're trying to farm. There are a number of things, you know, tax accountants and tax professionals. They're probably not. These are the types of things they hire out for. They may not understand all of these tax formulas and everything that goes into it. And you're right. We talk about the landscape that we're in now as opposed to what we were in a couple of years ago. I mean, gosh, we're talking, you know, $14 soybeans. As I look at the markets here, as we talk here this morning, we're still not back above $10 a bushel. I mean, $9.93 here as I look here at new crop soybeans, new crop corn. We're still under that $4 mark. This is a much different landscape than what we were in 2 years ago, and that's a game changer that this property tax formula and that these legislators at the State House can't understand unless they are a farmer, of which we only have one in the entire State House, and he happens to work for your organization.
Well, he is one of our officers, but yes, he works hard at Farm Bureau stuff and as being a legislator. So we appreciate the double and triple duty that Representative Culp does. But the one thing that we, I think, have been so over the last couple of years when bills have escalated a lot, I do think that farmers generally have been talking to legislators. But I would say that as we move into the session, we're hoping that, look, they may not, even our farmer members, look, they understand interest rates, they understand farm income, and that's basically, you know, for them, interest is an expense as well. And so they understand those kinds of dynamics. I think the other thing that they understand is when they look at their property tax bill, that where they'll be paying the next the second installment for this year, November 10th, that's going to be an inflection point. As we move up to that, a lot of farmers will be in the field, and they're definitely going to, as they're riding around the combine, they're going to be looking at the same pricing that you're following right now, so that you can, because that's where they're, they're going to be wondering when to sell, right? And what that's going to do to their overall income. So they know the constructs of what's going on, even if they don't know every little mathematical equation that goes into the base formula. So I have a lot of faith that, farmers are smart and know a lot about what is going on in their places. It's just how it impacts their bottom line. So I have a lot of hope there, and we will need every voice that we can possibly get to make sure that legislators are willing to give us some relief. Look, there's a lot of legislators who look and see publications where the selling price of farmland is $14,000, and all the way up to $80,000. Those $80,000 an acre prices for economic development, that really isn't an arms, but nevertheless, there are so many stories that go around about how much farm ground is worth to sell to somebody that they think, there are many legislators who believe that we're already really, in spite of how much they have gone up, which is, just to repeat that, it's 17%, 27%, and next year with no intervention, and we may not get an intervention for next year, but looking at impacting bills beyond that, it's another 20%. So no other type of property has had to experience those kind of increases.
Katrina, we've now started to see these gubernatorial candidates start to jump into this now. We had the lieutenant governor debate back in April, or back earlier here in August, and the libertarians put out their property tax plan. The Republicans put out their property tax plans. It was a couple of days after the lieutenant governor debate that the Democrats put out their plan. Mm-hmm. Everyone's talking about it now.
Right.
Have you had the opportunity to go through and kind of look at these plans, sort out some of the differences between these plans, and not necessarily say, this one would be better than this one or anything like that? I'm not asking you or Indiana Farm Bureau to endorse a plan. That's not what we're talking about here. But have you been able to sort out the differences between the plans and just talk about some of those differences and how they would really be able to go into effect should each person go into office, just kind of how they might play out in the end should those plans go into effect?
Right. Well, the first one, as I understand it, from Mr. Rainwater, is just elimination of property tax. And I don't know, honestly, that he has designated a kind of replacement revenue. There are some legislators who are pondering on that, too. I don't know that they're in coordination with him, but their frustration with the system is they're taking a look and talking about replacing that with and a sales tax on services. So we're in discussions with those legislators. I'll admit we haven't talked to Mr. Rainwater, but essentially that would be a real reform and change. I think the thing with any kind of a program that is that extensive is that you're gonna have local governments of every kind, as well as school corporations, who rely on property tax to be wondering where their revenue is going to come from. And so we would be wondering that too, because our members, especially in rural areas, are really dependent on those units of government to provide services, as well as, you know, that's a sense of community, et cetera. And so that would be in the realm of real tax reform per se. So, the plan from Senator Braun, we've talked to him a couple of times, and he has an analyst, a policy person who is working on various tax ideas. His primary plan was to increase the amount of homestead deduction, in other words, reduce the taxable value for homeowners, and then in addition to that, limit the growth in bills for them. I think it's to 2%. And for every other property, it's from year to year, you'd have an increase of 3% in your bill. The thing that we have relayed to them is two things is by increasing the homestead deduction, and a lot of legislators even have done that, what that does is cause shifts within the tax base. And so farmers would make up that part of the loss. And then also the 3%, 2% or 3% cap in the bill would also, in the same way that the circuit breakers work, the existing tax caps work, there would be lost revenue to local governments. And at this point, there aren't any official or public sort of analysis of what the loss would be to local government and schools. So we're waiting for that and to give more relief. But in general, I mean, would it be true that our members would love to, and farmers across the state would love to, just have an increase in their bill that's about 3%, which is sort of, you know, just a general cost of inflation without other factors? And so would they love to do that? I think that they would, but there are a lot of unanswered questions along with that proposal. We have been working with them pretty closely, because they're asking, and we've shared our concepts about how we thought the formula could be improved, the base formula could be improved. So, but at the end of the day, you know, they're just as with the Democrats' plan, they're going to have to work with members of the General Assembly in both houses and both caucuses to come up with an agreement. It won't be just one group gets everything that they want. Just so that's the reality of the dynamic. So the McCormick Gooden plan, they are actually basing it on some legislation that was filed a couple of years ago, and essentially that's more targeted relief towards homeowners and people over 65, et cetera. So it tries to surgically go in and hit the points that are problematic, but it doesn't necessarily provide relief to farmland owners. So we honestly haven't had a moment to yet. The August is pretty busy. And we've been out on the road, you know, just talking about our basic issues. So we need to get with them and make sure that they're aware of our issues. But I would say that plenty of people that within the Farm Bureau system have been talking to Representative Gooden, and we've had in particular a good relationship with him because he was in the legislature and was just until recently the rural development director for USDA. And so our relationship with him is really open. We just haven't quite gotten to that yet.
You made a good point in there that I do want to go back to, and that is that regardless of who gets elected as governor and who takes over as lieutenant governor, their plan for property taxes may not matter. It's going to take an entire legislature to make this change, because this isn't something that can just be, you know, appointed by the governor. The governor doesn't just get to come in and say, all right, here's the tax plan. This is going to be something that has to filter down through an entire legislation.
Well, I mean, governors generally have their own legislative package and, platform. And so that's the reality. I mean, we have two super majorities, so there's obviously going to be deference there. And I wouldn't want to portray that any other way, because, they're looking at the policy objectives here too. So, just in the same way, I mean, the Democrat caucuses in the General Assembly have their own principles, policy principles that would go into a system. But the reality is, as I mentioned, is that we've had an internal task force that's been working for not quite a year, focusing on this and trying to figure out what are the best things for us to pursue at the General Assembly. And the legislature has, for almost 2 years, had a state and local tax review task force that's met several times. We've met with the two primary leaders of that committee, Representative Thompson, who's the chairman of Ways and Means, and Senator Holdman, who's the chair of Tax and Fiscal in the Senate. So we've been communicating with them and letting them know. I testified before that committee on, I think it was June 16th. And so anybody that just really wants to hear all that in a detailed way about the formula, that's what I tried to educate them about, the specifics, so that they at least had some background about the problems that farmers are facing with escalating taxes. So we've had good communications with them. That started out as a committee who was looking at eliminating our state income tax. We would have our members have problems with that, and definitely told us that in our policy setting sessions this year and this summer. Mainly because we think income tax is based on your ability to pay, and our state income tax is already pretty low. So that wasn't, but that kind of lost steam in the last several months. And so the emphasis has shifted to how the property tax system would be reformed, as well as looking at, and that's several elements, like what do you do for homeowners? What do you do for farmland? Of course, where that's our thing. There will be some business groups who want to get rid of personal property. And as far as that concept, our members hate paying that. But on the other hand, we don't know how all these ideas depend on, in the end, how everybody's turns out, you know, what the fiscal analysis says. And so we're looking and extending our research into those areas so that we'll be able to respond to those ideas as they come across the desk in January.
I want to take a time out here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. We're talking with Katrina Hall with Indiana Farm Bureau. When we come back, Katrina, I want to talk about what the response has been from some of the legislators you've been talking to, what we've been hearing from them thus far as we head toward this legislative session that's really not too far away if we really think about it. And I also do want to hear more about some of the other tax reform issues to really make this more of a permanent thing going forward that you had mentioned earlier on in the program. Mm-hmm. So when we come back, we're going to talk about those things. Today's podcast, again, brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, also by Indiana Farm Bureau and Beck's Hybrids. We'll be back in a moment.
There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Beck's, we stand up for the things that matter most: our faith, our independence, and helping farmers succeed. As the largest family-owned seed company in the U.S., we believe in the integrity of remaining an independent family-owned seed company. Since our founding in 1937, we have continued to produce quality products backed by a quality family of employees and dealers dedicated to serving American farmers. And that's something to be proud of. Beck's, founded in faith, forged in America. For more information, visit beckshybrids.com.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
Back on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Eric Pfeiffer here, Katrina Hall there. And Katrina, I do want to talk about just the reaction that we're getting from folks in the legislature. I know that as we go back and we look, you know, the Indiana State Fair was just wrapped up here recently. I know that there, you know, we had the Rural Caucus. I know you were chatting with them. This has to be a major point of concern for them, because this is a large part. You know, you talk about the Rural Caucus that I believe Jean Lysing really kind of really she heads, and she, I mean, this is her people. She really, really talks to, you know, the Senate and her colleagues in the Senate Ag Committee. This has to be a major point of contention for them. This is their constituency. This is rural Indiana speaking. Right. Saying this is a problem. You were speaking with them. What was the reception like as they talk about property taxes?
Well, especially at the Rural Caucus, where people come, I mean, legislators come, and I think there were 35, between 30 and 40 legislators that showed up at any given time on that day. That's kind of an annual event where the ag community, you know, provides information to legislators so that they, you know, in preparation for the session. So we were lucky to be the headline, act for that this year. And so they dedicated a whole hour to talking about not only farmland taxes, but other dynamics in tax reform. So my reception, for the most part, certainly in that forum where you're close to that many legislators all at once, you can see their reaction. They listened really intently. I mean, people that are coming, legislators that are coming to that are really, I mean, they're from rural areas. They're concerned about what's going on in rural Indiana. And so, you know, they're attuned to what's going on. I think they really paid attention intently. So I felt really encouraged by that. Now there are, and I would say too, that there are a lot of urban legislators that we work with at Farm Bureau. And many times that's reaching across the aisle. And I think they also understand our issues and are open to that. You know, there are always going to be a few legislators who, do not necessarily, as I said earlier, embrace the conditions that farmers face. They look at farmers who may own, you know, several hundred acres or thousands of acres and say, hey, you're rich, so you can just pay those taxes. So there's a little bit of that back and forth. But in the end, it is important that not only individual legislators understand the issues, but also that the leaders of their caucus, the Speaker of the House, the Minority Leader in the House, the Chairman of Ways and Means, and those, and the fiscal leaders, you know, understand our issues. And we do have a lot of communication with them. So I feel like our reception is as good as it can be expected right now. I mean, look, based on, you know, the dynamics and the progression of issues that the state and local tax review task force has taken a look at. There are a lot of people who are looking at them and like, this is our opportunity to get some tax relief, but they don't necessarily have the same dramatically increasing taxes that we do in agriculture. So I feel like it's pretty respectful and pretty good. I would say that, you know, getting relief for agriculture will not be an easy job, but and there is a lot of focus among legislative leaders about how homeowners are impacted by escalating taxes as well, and in particular people that are over 65 and are on a fixed income. They do worry about them being essentially priced out of their home because the value goes up, you know, due to market conditions. They don't have any more money to pay increased taxes. So there is a lot of focus on that in particular.
And frankly, as we talk about this property tax discussion, there are a lot more of just homeowners than there are right. Farm landowners. I mean, it's just that's the fact of the matter. I mean, that's just where we're at. So right. Which means a lot more voters of just homeowners than farmland owners. I think that that's no secret.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And even though farmland is about, I mean, there are different statistics, right? It's about 70% of the land mass in our state. So we feel like, hey, we're out there, you see us, right? Well, that's not where the population focus is. And it also is so more, you know, our legislative seats are based on population. And so there's more legislators representing more populated areas. Yeah. So, but I think through the advocacy efforts that we do at Farm Bureau, I think that has helped us bridge the gap with legislators who might not have as much of a rural area. We work really hard on a daily basis to have the best working relationships with legislators we can. They know that they can call us for information and, about any topic, really. So taxes will be one of our priorities, but certainly water is the other thing that's overshadowing, I think, this General Assembly, and certainly it is a primary focus for Indiana Farm Bureau. So we'll have a lot of things going, but getting that message out there also as grassroots organization, it really depends on the advocacy of our members and the ag community just in general to talk about those taxes, which for us is really a bottom line issue.
Well, and I was getting ready to go there, Katrina, because it really seems like, you know, as Andy Tower calls it the barnyard. We got to have the whole barnyard right. coming together here.
Right.
You know, we need these different organizations, Indiana Farm Bureau, the Indiana Corn Growers, the Indiana
right.
Soybean Alliance.
Right.
We need all of these organizations coming together here. I want to go back a couple few years here and have you kind of, you know, compare and contrast. It wasn't that long ago that Indiana Farm Bureau's top priority at the State House was trying to push forward this bill that would bring insurance for its members.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And boy, did members come out in droves coming there to the State House and helping push right. this thing across the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to take that?
I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that we need for this, because, because as I said, there are so many, you know, people or groups that are wanting their part of the tax relief pie that you really, I mean, if you don't speak out, you know, you're going to get left behind. And so, so we will need those kinds of efforts. We know that we've got a lot of, education to do within the ag community, and we're preparing and we're ready to do that. I mean, we've got, we know the issue, as I've said, and so we just have to figure out how to get it into digestible bites. But as I said, farmers are smart and they're dealing with the elements of the formula every day. So I'm not too worried about them understanding it, but they're also really busy. We're going into the harvest, you know, I see beans ripening up everywhere, and, you know, it's not going to be very long before they're all in the field. And so, so we'll need, it will be a challenge to round up the troops, but we will need that relief. And I think that the combination of the priorities that we have couldn't be more serious for agriculture, not only on the tax front, but certainly including the discussion about water. And because there's a lot of push and pull in that arena as well, which I know that you have or will have somebody on a podcast to give details about that. But it is, we've got some serious issues going on. So we do need to, you know, we just have to get our act together. But, and really, I would say, especially when we got tax relief in the 2016 session, you know, our members did the same thing. That was sort of that was a really big win for us. I mean, since that was passed, I mean, we don't want to pretend like that formula hasn't given farmers across the state a lot of tax relief, because it is hundreds of millions of dollars every year in relief that farmers are getting from the formula. It's just that technical issues are interfering with its performance. But it's just like I said, there are a lot of different ideas and that are coming out of committees and so are, you know, in legislators' minds. So we have to make sure that we're getting to the forefront of all of that. You know, it's just a matter of, and I hate to say the squeaky wheel gets the, you know, gets the grease, because that seems so.
It makes you sound so squeaky.
Well, it sounds like it's just not, you know, it's just an annoyance, where these things are problems that can impact agriculture for years to come. So it's not just like, and you know, who does that anymore? Slaps grease. I don't know. But anyway, so that's kind of that's an old term, but it is true that legislators need to hear from folks. And we'll try to provide the most, you know, effective and, I wouldn't say they're easy, but you know, suggestions about how that they should reach out to them. So, you know, that's, it's an age old problem, but I feel like at Farm Bureau work, we're definitely experts at that. And we're also, I believe, experts at collaborating with other agricultural groups and, you know, and listening to the things that are important to them as well. So, you know, we don't always agree on everything, but we do try to come in with a collaborative solidarity when you know, there's a lot on the line.
Well, I remember some years back when that you know, healthcare bill was going through and legislators trying to walk through the hallway and they couldn't get through. All these darn farmers are in the way. I mean, that's really what we're going to need to get something like this through. So we hope to see them there. You mentioned earlier on in the program, Katrina, that. You know, yes, we're talking about this formula. We're talking about things that we could change within the property tax formula to try to make some adjustments here. But we're also trying to talk about tax reform to try to make this perhaps more permanent. I know that when we did the podcast with Andy and Kendall before, that was one thing that Kendall talked about. And he's, we've got to try to make this more permanent. We've got to try to do something to where we don't have to go back every, you know, 5, 6, 7. We don't want to keep going back for this. We want to make something more permanent. What are some of those potential solutions? What are some of those things that we could be doing or that we at least need to broach the discussion? What are some of those things?
Okay. Well, one of the things, the mechanisms that's in the, well, first of all, we have data that show we don't get any other kinds of deductions that any other property gets, a deduction or a lowering of our assessed value by a dollar amount or a percentage. Homeowners get, you know, $45,000 wiped off to begin with, and then they get another 60% of what's left. And this is the thing, when you do something that dramatic, which in essentially would be about half your tax base, by the time they apply those that deduction to homeowners, they're only paying on about half of the value that is calculated by an assessor. And I've been doing a lot of research recently, and that's just pretty consistent. So we don't get any relief from any mechanisms like that. There are some legislators who would like to explore that kind of a concept. And we would be open to that. I think, how do you determine what that would be one thing. But I would say that, so that's one element. We have consistently talked about more reliance on local option income tax to reduce property taxes. And in the counties that have done that, their tax rates and their bills are a lot lower. For instance, Representative Culp used the example. I was out on the road with him this week talking to taxpayers across his district, and his taxes per acre, because his county has adopted substantial local option income taxes to reduce their rates, is $18 an acre, whereas members of his family farm on the other side of the county line and their tax per acre is $38. So that does provide some essential relief. So how those, even just saying that that the counties have to have a certain level, if they want an income tax, they have to have a certain level of property tax relief would go a long way in helping our members. The other thing that has been in the statute for several years now, and everybody knows it because they can see the impacts of it, if they are in, especially if they're in a municipality, is the impact and the tax relief from the tax caps, or what technically are called circuit breakers. When those were instituted in the law and then eventually put in the Constitution, farmland was started out in the 3%. So we argued diligently and were able to move that to the 2%. But in rural areas where tax rates are lower, they don't have that additional layer of taxes from municipalities. That means that it is only, there are very few places where farmland gets any relief from the circuit breakers. So one of the things that our tax task force talked about and that I have broached with fiscal leaders is that we do have an interest. They could statutorily lower the tax cap threshold for farmland and farm buildings, and that would provide some relief. Our delegates adopted the 1.5% circuit breaker for farmland and buildings, and the problem with that, once again, is our members might not think that's a problem, but there is a certain, with circuit breakers, there is loss to local government. So nevertheless, we are talking about that broad concept. And beyond that, I think that one of the things that that we've been supportive of, and it is highlighted as we talk about our policies, is that there is a certain element of property taxation that can be used as to incent farmland staying as farmland. As we go across the state, where people on any interstate see miles and miles of warehouses. And certainly the LEAP District has, with its large footprint with solar projects encompassing thousands of acres, the loss of farmland is really on the minds of farmers across the state. And so trying to protect farmland, I mean, yes, but I mean, protecting it as farmland. So there are ways that we could develop a program that would incent that. It's what we're calling it sort of a classified farmland approach. And our tax task force embraced that. And we're still working on developing what the concepts for that might be. But the goal, honestly, would be to get some sort of a tax relief for a designated period of time. And if you sell it for development, then you're going to have to pay that relief back. I mean, we're trying to keep farmland in, you know, in agriculture. And so we'll see how that goes. But that's another broad sort of, as long as there are property taxes, we're always, and as long as every session they're up for grabs, you know, we'll always be working on different elements that are the complexities of the system, because you know, it's just a complex system, and unless you completely do away with it, which there is, as I said, one or two legislators who are in earnest looking at doing that, the results of that would not be, it would be controversial. It would be extending 7% sales tax to services, not including medical, I think is where they are landing. And we've certainly adopted policy this time that said we might support that, but we're not going to do it if it's on custom services and the services that are within our creation, you know, production of crops, so, and livestock, et cetera. So there's a lot on the table. I mean, honestly, just about every idea you could possibly think of is floating. So it is it's sort of a spinning top around my head these days.
It's time to get creative is what your members are saying. I think is
exactly. I mean, they do want something that is more simple and understandable, and I can completely sympathize with that.
But what I think they're saying, Katrina, yeah, is that we don't want like no tax. Like they're still very passionate about making sure that their rural communities are thriving and that they have the services that they need in those rural communities. I think that that's been a recurring theme in what you've been saying here, is that we don't want this property tax system to be overly cumbersome, and we don't want to be paying through the nose, because there's got to be a better solution than that. But we still need to make sure that our rural communities are thriving. We still need to make sure that are taxes here. Like that's still the crux of what this is all about.
Right. And just because we would, even if it is achieved, to eliminate property taxes altogether, ironically, 25 years ago when I came to work at Farm Bureau, that was the theme, stop taxing property. And at that time, I mean, the question was, you can't just say stop taxing and not expect that you're going to pick up the tab on some other sort of asset or activity that you're doing. So, and look, property taxes right now in total are about $9 billion. And I mean, I could go on and talk about this all day, but I think the thing is to replace that takes a lot of taxes being generated from somewhere else. So just remember that, you know, there isn't a free lunch as far as paying for local government. Although, you know, the General Assembly, you know, is frankly, just like anything, picks winners and losers. And we just don't want to be, the loser. I think that would be the way to put it. So it requires people speaking up so that isn't what happens.
And that's why you're asking Indiana Farm Bureau, all of the other ag organizations, asking for farmers to show up at the State House, really, you know, during the General Assembly when it opens up in January. But even before then, start talking to your legislator now. Get their ear.
Call them from the combine is what I'm saying. I mean, you know, that or have them out to your farm and, you know, let them ride around in a coming. Every legislator wants the picture, right, with a farmer, because people like farmers and they want to represent their constituents too. So, you know, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, that Representative Culp's our only actual working farmer in the General Assembly. There are others who have roots, but once they're they've kind of moved away from the farm after they got there. So there are plenty of people who still have roots in that, but it is a matter of bridging that gap between the people who know about agriculture and those that just don't have that background. So honestly, legislative relationships is just, we used to have a saying that it's all about relationships, and that just honestly is so true.
Katrina, thank you for joining us today on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast and getting into the nuts and bolts of this property tax issue. I'm going to take a guess here that this isn't going to be the last time we chat with you about this over the next several months. Just a hunch. I
really hope not, because I enjoy doing this.
I hope you're willing to come back. I hope you're willing to come back.
Absolutely. I really would be glad to. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk about this.
Thanks for joining us on this edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Catch us again next time. The podcast brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. Also by Indiana Farm Bureau and Bex Hybrids. I'm Eric Pfeiffer. The Indiana Ag Policy Podcast is a presentation of Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.